I withdrew to near the heavily curtained window and seated myself upon some cushions, to watch the progress of events, suspecting strongly that my master did not desire that I should behold all he did, although he required my presence in the room. Chapter 13. My Angel of Light. Nearly an hour passed. Jalaluddin hung all the time over the precious pot and its contents, scarce turning to look at me, but muttering strange incantations from time to time, and making with his wand mystic figures in the air, or throwing fresh scented powder into the brazier. He seemed to be absorbed in his experiment, and almost oblivious of my presence. My clairvoyant sight seemed unusually clear, for I beheld around us more distinctly than ever, the cloudy phantoms of the astral plane, who seemed to float around the room and pass through the walls and ceiling and rise up through the floor as though the solid masonry had been a barrier of water or of air. Only the ring of magic fire kept them away from us, and as the precious liquid simmered in the vessel they appeared to gather in ever-thickening clouds, pressing forward upon one another until those next the flaming ring were almost forced through it by the pressure from behind. How shall I describe the multiform variety of strange, grotesque and horrible creatures that I saw? Some large, and towering like giant phantoms over all the rest, others, winged like unto a mixture of men and dragons, creatures that resembled wild beasts in their bodies, yet had the faces of men, imps and dwarfs, some all huge heads with scarce any bodies, others, all large bloated bodies and no heads. Phantoms that were in all respects like unto men and women, yet of bodies so unsubstantial that they seemed to dissolve like smoke wreaths, and then form into shape again. Beings that were like all the fantastic creations of man's wandering thoughts, and yet possessing each its own individuality, its curious resemblance to the human type. Wild and horrible looking human spirits, earthbound and miserable, mingled with this phantom throng, and fought with them in a fierce desire to approach and grasp this precious essence of life. Huge misty shapes drew near, like and yet unlike to men, and hovered like brooding spirits of evil around the fiery ring. Here and there, a head or arm, a foot or face, would suddenly receive materiality from the powerful atmosphere of material magnetism which we had generated around us, and vivified with the emanations from the precious life-giving elixir, and with the materiality this head or foot or face would become distinct and visible to Jalaluddin's sight as well as to mine, causing him to redouble his precautions and replenish his wavering circle of fire, through which the wild phantom horde threatened at every moment to burst in a great torrent of destroying fiends of darkness. Distant rumbling as of thunder resounded above us and approached us, as fresh and yet ever fresh hordes of black spirits gathered round. The house appeared to rock and sway with the assaults of this mighty multitude of unknown foes, and as time passed on, and drop by drop of the precious mixture fell into the golden bowl, the excitement around us seemed to approach a climax, and each moment, methed, would be our last. And now a change passed over the vital fluid distilling into the golden bowl. A crimson cloud arose above it, then changed into rose color, and faded into a delicate pink, then changed again to violet and lilac, then into blue, green and yellow, and lastly into silver and white, till a glow as of the rainbow cloud hung above the mystic jar containing it. At this moment I became conscious that in the darkness of the curtains where I sat there gleamed a star, a faint star, yet there it shone. And as I turned to gaze at it, I saw again my angel of light, unseen through all the long years since my childhood, but visible again at last. She looked not, however, as I had seen her before, radiant and bright, her robes glittering with silver stars. She was dim and misty, as though I beheld her through a cloud of mist. Her face, too, was sad. Her eyes looked as though she wept. Her long garments seemed to cling to her, as though drenched with her own tears. She held out her arms to me imploringly, and beckoned to me to come. And I arose to follow her, for I could not resist the pleading of her looks, and my heart was stirred at the sight of her by the old passionate feeling of love and longing to clasp her to my heart. I forgot the experiments. I had well nigh forgotten Jalaluddin, as I rose to follow my white angel from that dread room of mystery and fear. As I raised a corner of the curtain to pass out, I looked back. There stood Jalaluddin, bending like an old, old man as he stooped over the precious golden bowl, almost filled now with the life-giving fluid. His hands were outstretched like the claws of a bird of prey that waits to clutch its expected food. His eyes were fixed with greedy expectancy upon the last few drops as they slowly fell one by one into the bowl. He seemed lost to all thoughts but the one great thought of self-preservation. Above his head floated the rainbow cloud, around him glimmered the ring of pale blue flame, and outside the fierce phantoms fought like maniacs in their frantic efforts to break through. I dropped the curtain and passed out, impelled by a power stronger than my sense of fidelity to Jalal ad-Din, stronger than any influence I had yet felt, and followed the figure of my white angel as she led me on, floating before me, her head half turned to see that I still followed, until we reached the place where my horse was stabled. There she paused, and pointing to the door, vanished from my sight. Chapter 14. The Magic Scroll. As my white angel disappeared, I remembered my master, and full of remorse at having thus abandoned him, I hurried back to the house. As I entered the room I saw that the mystic circles of flame had died out although the fire still burned in the brazier, and by its light I saw that the vessel for distilling the elixir lay on the floor, near it lay the golden bowl, overturned and empty, save for a single drop of the golden fluid. Beside it lay the sorcerer himself, dead. It did not need that I should look at his distorted limbs twisted and contorted in all the agonies of a violent death, at his eyes, staring from their sockets and staring in wide open fear of some unknown thing of terror, at his half-open mouth from which the swollen tongue protruded, and from which some drops of black blood oozed, to tell me that was past all human aid. His robe had fallen back from one arm, which was bent above his head as if to ward off an attack. On the bare wrist were the marks of giant fingers, scorched and burnt into the flesh like the marks from a hot iron, and on his throat were marks of a similar hand, which had evidently strangled him. I drew back from the fearful sight in horror and remorse, and my first thought was to fly from the accursed place. Then I bethought me of the sorcerer's many valuable manuscripts, containing in some of them knowledge that was of priceless value, and not all evil, embodying as it did the patient researches of many years of labor in the pursuit of scientific knowledge, and I knew that so soon as Jalal ad-Din's death should be discovered, his house would be pillaged and his papers destroyed or carried away. I resolved, therefore, to place them for safety in the vault beneath the fountain, until opportunity was afforded to me to take them away. I accordingly put as many of them as I could there, taking with me three, which I knew referred only to the practice of the medical art. I also took with me the black wand and the magic mirror. Having gathered up my own possessions, which were in my room together with some gems of value, which Jalal ad-Din had at various times given to me, I returned to the room where the dead man lay, and was about to leave the house when my eyes fell upon the rapidly stiffening figure of the unfortunate sorcerer, and I thought that I would throw a cover over the ghastly face. I could not bring myself to touch him, to close those staring eyes or straighten those twisted limbs, but as I took up one of the tiger skins to place over him I saw the papyrus scroll within the bosom of his robe, and filled with curiosity to read its secret, I drew it out and thrust it into my girdle. As I did so, I could not but notice that the same extraordinary change, which had once at least, to my knowledge, passed over the living body of the magician had come over it now. Since I had first beheld it, the dead body had begun to shrink and shrivel up. The yellow skin hung in a thousand creases on the shrunken frame. The look of age was beyond anything one could imagine, and in that shriveled withered form it was difficult to recognize Jalal ad-Din. It was as though he was turning into dust before my eyes, and I wondered as I looked down upon him, whether there would be more than a heap of bones, a little dust and a pile of clothing, by the time the black slave Taki returned and his master's death was discovered. It was as though the earth was claiming all at once the decaying body of, which it had been so long defrauded. As I turned away and left the dead magician amidst the paraphernalia of his mystic art, which had proved so powerless to save him from the grim hand of death, I felt as if the spell, which had hung over me for 4 years was broken at last, and I had awakened as from a dream, restored to my freedom of will once more. It appeared as though a sudden access of life and vigor filled my veins. The strange lassitude that had of late oppressed me with a feeling of having all my limbs weighed down by invisible weights, and which deprived me of the energy to think or plan for myself, was gone. I felt once more that I could do or dare, not as the tool of another, but as one who fights and labors for himself. As I passed into the gray light of morning, I thought of that other morning 4 years before, when I had come from my first visit to Jalal ad-Din in that house of darkness, and passed into the clear light of the dawning day, and I questioned within myself whether the knowledge I had gained had indeed been worth the price I had paid for it, resolving, as I thought over all these things, that I would turn to a good use on behalf of my fellow men the wisdom I had learned amidst so much evil. Having saddled my horse, I lost no time in quitting the city, for I knew that under the circumstances of Jalal ad-Din's death at a time when he and I had been alone together, it would be impossible to convince anyone that I was innocent of his murder, and I resolved to put a wide space between myself and the dead man before the death should be discovered. I rode onward, avoiding all villages and towns, till night fell, when I encamped upon a rocky eminence, and lighted a fire with brushwood to keep away the beasts of prey, which prowled around. I did not venture to sleep, although I was growing terribly fatigued by the excitement and the exertions of the past day and night, but I lay down beside my horse, and drawing the papyrus roll from my girdle, resolved to keep myself awake by reading it, which, thanks to my studies with Jalal ad-Din, I was able to do. It began by setting forth the various means by which the vital fluid could be renewed, and in what substances it could be found in the purest state. Then it gave some directions for extracting it, and went on to explain that for those who had already renewed their span of life to thrice the period allotted unto man, it required a stronger and yet ever stronger degree of power in the vital elixir to enable the atoms of the body to hold together. It then went on to say that, as with each renewal of life the crumbling body required yet more and more of the vitality to be incessantly poured into it as food, the writer advised that either the fast decaying body should be abandoned and a fresh body from which the lawful spirit owner had been ejected should be taken possession of, or else that some young and vigorous person, in whose veins the blood yet coursed warm and red and full of vitality, should be kept in close proximity to the seeker after perpetual life, in order that the young fresh life should feed with its magnetism the one whose body was old, and thus save it from the terrapid waste of the precious fluid it had absorbed. Or, said the manuscript, if you dost prefer it, you seeker after endless life, you canst suck as a vampire spirit the life from many a slumbering mortal, returning to your own mortal covering ere dawn to renew its life with the life you hast thus gained. Yet beware that you dost not try this means of sustaining life after you hast for the fifth time drunk of the great elixir, for by the time you hast tasted of it for the fifth time you canst no more with safety leave your crumbling shell, else will it turn into swift decay and leave your spirit without mortal covering. There be some that claim that they can construct a newer body for themselves. Yea, and it is even so. Yet this body will hold together for so brief a space of time, it were not possible to cling to earth by such means. From time to time the spirit may manifest itself through such a body, but it can enjoy none of the pleasures of the earth life while in it, since all its efforts must be directed to preserving it from disintegration. If, then, you dost desire to live the life of mortal men, then you must steal a body from another, or else steal from many the mortal life essence, which shall sustain your own. There is yet a third and darker way by which those who find they cannot possess themselves of the body of another may yet steal from him his young, fresh life. Let there be an elixir made, the strongest and the most powerful that can be distilled, and when the rainbow cloud shall form, and the last golden drops fall within the bowl, let the man with strong young life throbbing in all his veins draw near and touch the vessel wherein is contained this strong elixir, for as the stronger body doth attract the weaker, as the larger draws to it the smaller, as the lodestone draws to it the iron, so will the powerful life within the bowl draw to it the life contained within the mortal body of the youth, and as the mortal body, deprived thus suddenly of its young life, shall sink upon the ground, He who can drink at once of the grand elixir shall absorb both the life that was contained within the body of the youth and that contained in the magic liquid. So shall he renew his life for yet another 100 years, or it may be even more. Yet let him beware. The powers of darkness are not mocked, for behold, I had read so far, and was about to turn the page, when from the darkness of the night there came forth a hand. A gigantic hand, that terminated at the wrist, which grasped the papyrus scroll and snatched it from my hold, vanishing with it as suddenly as it had appeared. Thus did the secrets it contained remain in greater part a secret still. But I had read enough. I knew now why Jalal ad-Din had been so disturbed by the reading of it, and why he no longer dared to meet my gaze. And I recognized with an emotion of thankfulness the sudden death from which my angel of light had saved me. Chapter 15. I meet Zuleika. I made my way through Persia into the hill country of Afghanistan, and in the city of Herat I took up my abode. I had resolved to practice as a professor of the medical art, and with the knowledge taught me by Jalal ad-Din, I wrought many successful cures. With the darker mysteries I tampered not, for the horror of my master's death was yet strong upon me, and although I kept his magic wand and the mirror, and certain other things, I did not use them, and such gifts of divination as I possessed, I used at this time only to aid me in my work of healing those who came to me for help. Ere long I made for myself an honorable reputation, and was sent for by even the highest class of citizens, and for a time I remained quietly and contentedly living as one highly respected and esteemed. And now I bethought myself of taking unto me another wife. I had learned from the manuscripts of Jalal ad-Din how to guard my body when my spirit should be absent from it, and I had taken occasion to go thus unknown to visit the wife whom I had left among the robber tents in the mountains of Persia. I found her, as I expected, already wed unto my rival Haji. The old chief was dead, and Haji ruled in his stead over the tribe, while Dilfarib ruled with no gentle hand over Haji. I therefore felt myself to be at liberty to find another partner, and began to look round at all the fair maidens whose parents I knew. My idea of love had been somewhat sullied in my life with Jalal ad-Din. Women no longer appeared such sacred divinities to me, and I had begun to despair of ever meeting one who could inspire in my heart a romantic attachment. Little did I dream that the crisis of my life, so far as love was concerned, was so near at hand. There was an Arabian merchant in the city with whom I was somewhat intimate, and on my mentioning my desire to find a wife, he invited me to visit his family. He had, he said, 3 daughters, each of whom was esteemed to be beautiful, and I might choose, if I pleased, one of them. Accordingly, I was invited to a feast, after which these maidens were each in turn to unveil before me. The merchant had a niece as well as 3 daughters, and as the youngest daughter had already set her affections upon a youth, it was agreed among the girls themselves that the niece should quietly take her place without telling the merchant, for as the youngest daughter was considered the most beautiful, it was feared that I might select her. The niece, whose name was Zuleika, was the orphan daughter of the merchant's brother, who had settled in Turkey and married a Circassian lady of great beauty but faithless disposition, who had escaped with her lover, leaving behind the little daughter who was their only child. At the father's death, this girl had been adopted by the good merchant, Abu Hassan, and brought up with his own daughters. I need not dwell upon the entertainment given to me by the merchant, nor describe the charms of the 2 elder daughters, whose blushing faces were momentarily unveiled to my eyes without exciting more than a passing sensation of admiration for their comeliness. The 3rd girl, whom the merchant imagined to be his youngest daughter, drew her veil very slightly aside, showing to me a face which surpassed the others in beauty of feature and perfection of coloring. But it was not her loveliness which caused the sudden throb of my heart, the quick rush of blood through all my veins, but the fact that as this 3rd maiden unveiled before me I recognized the long-sought-for face of the girl I had seen in the magic mirror, on that eventful night when I had first visited Jalal ad-Din. Chapter 16. My marriage with Zuleika. The worthy merchant Abu Hassan was somewhat chagrined when he found that his niece and not his daughter had been selected to become my wife, and he was angry at the trick which had been played upon him. However, being somewhat of a philosopher, He consoled himself with the reflection that in any case it was well that Zuleika should be provided for, and gave his assent to our union not ungraciously. I pressed for an early marriage, for if the mere reflection of this girl's face projected to me in a mirror had so entranced my senses, her bodily presence had doubly enchained my heart, and I was consumed by the most impatient desire to marry her with as little delay as possible. Of the strange warning against her, which her appearance in the mirror had conveyed to me, I thought but little, attributing to the influence of Jalal ad-Din's room all that had conveyed a suggestion of evil in Zuleika herself. She was but a young girl brought up in the strict seclusion of her uncle's home, and it was impossible to look at the guileless innocence of her lovely face, with its modestly drooping dark eyes that would scarce raise themselves to look at me, and still associate a thought of evil with her. No. I felt sure she was an angel of goodness and purity, and I longed with all my soul to hasten the day, which should make her my own. The jewels, which had been given to me by Jalal ad-Din were, as I have said, of considerable value, and I had thought it as well to part with them to a merchant who dealt in precious stones. I had, moreover, made a good deal of money by the practice of the healing art, so that I was in a position to make my presents to the bride and her family both numerous and costly, and I was accordingly treated with a corresponding amount of favor. Zuleika herself I did not again behold unveiled, but I was permitted several interviews in the presence of her family, and the impression she had made upon me was, if possible, deepened each time. At last all the many customs and ceremonies attending a marriage in the East had been complied with, and I was permitted to take my bride home to my own house at last. The time, which followed, was one of such intense happiness, of such an intoxication of love, that even now, after all this lapse of time, I sigh as I look back upon it, and would fain, were it but possible, recall again, if but for an hour, the illusions and the bliss of that time. That Zuleika should love me as much as I loved her was not to be expected. Only in the perfect union between twin souls is found the perfect unity of love, and Zuleika was in many respects the opposite of my true ideal, although she had so completely usurped the place of it, that I could no longer dream of any perfections which were not possessed by her. She was clever, witty, and full of resources. She never palled upon nor wearied me, as poor Dilfarib had done. Zuleika seemed to divine my thoughts ere I could utter them, and gratify my wishes when they were but half formed in my own mind. Although ignorant of life, her intuitions were so keen she never appeared awkward or at a loss, even under the most trying circumstances. By nature a coquette, she learnt almost at once the arts by which women enslave men, and make the cleverest and the most worldly of us mere puppets in their hands. She was an actress by instinct, and it came more easily and naturally to her to feign an emotion than to feel one, for she was herself incapable of real deep feeling of any kind, save inasmuch as she desired always to enjoy the highest measure of comfort possible for herself. She could not understand the absolute devotion with which I worshipped her, the passionate jealousy I suppressed at beholding her bestow her caresses upon even a pet bird, that I should be thereby robbed of even a little of the love I desired to make all my own. She never guessed how I hungered for her kisses, how I trembled and how my heart beat with the wildest emotion at every touch of her soft hand. Through how many long nights have I lain awake, unable to sleep by reason of the fever of thoughts, which burned like fire in my brain, watching her as she lay serenely asleep in my arms, noting every feature of her face, every shadow of expression, and wondering of what she dreamed, longing with passionate vehemence to know her thoughts, and whether her dreams were of me and of my love. I would have given so much to read her thoughts, and to know what share I had in the emotions of her soul, but although she could read my thoughts, hers were a sealed book to me, of which I could never, with all my powers of divination, read one line. I think there were times when my vehemence bewildered and wearied her. I exacted so much that she grew at last to be somewhat tired of the endless demands I made upon her love. Her little bits of acting were done listlessly, and in my disappointment and suspicious jealousy I would reproach her with coldness and indifference, till her large, beautiful eyes would regard me in languid astonishment. She was quite happy, why could not I be so? She would ask, and then she would rouse herself to bestow upon me the coveted caress, which for a time removed the cloud from my brow, the suspicion that she was indifferent to me from my heart. I do not think it is ever possible for natures such as mine to be perfectly happy upon earth, where the clouds of uncertainty, the disappointments and disillusionments that are inseparable from all earthly things, perpetually afford food for jealousy and suspicion, and where the hunger of the heart seldom finds full satisfaction. But in spite of many drawbacks, I think that during the first years of my union with Zuleika, I tasted as full a measure of happiness as ever falls to the lot of mankind, and certainly had I known what the years, which followed were to bring to me, I should have valued the comparative happiness of that time still more highly than I did. Chapter 17, The Son of Artemisia. I had been married a little over 3 years, and although no child had been given to crown my hopes, I was too deeply in love with Zuleika to feel this as a great disappointment, dearly as I loved children and greatly as I had desired to have a child of my own. My fame as a physician had spread for many miles around Herat, and I was sent for by the highest officials of the court of the Afghan princes. I was not greatly surprised, therefore, to receive a summons to attend at the palace, as a young kinsman of the Emir had been seized with violent convulsions, which no one was able to relieve. The Grand Vizier, who was one of my patients, having mentioned my name to the prince, I was sent for in all haste. On being shown into the chamber where the sufferer lay, I found that he was a young man of about my own age, handsome but somewhat effeminate looking, and evidently weak of will. A glance at him showed me that this was no common case of epilepsy, but that the unfortunate prince was the victim of a form of demoniac possession, which is far more common than is usually supposed. To my clairvoyant sight it appeared as if a black spirit of a low type was making frequent and violent efforts to withdraw the rightful possessor of the young man's body, and enter into that covering himself, much as one man may forcibly wrench another's cloak from off his shoulders in spite of his efforts at resistance. The fearful contortions of the prince were caused by the resistance of his half-conscious spirit against the would-be despoiler. Hastily uttering some words, which I had learnt from Jalal ad-Din, and knew to possess a powerful effect upon spirits of this class, I advanced slowly towards the prince, keeping my eye steadily fixed upon the dark being struggling with him, and throwing all the powers of my will into my determination to make him release the young man. The dark being cowered down before me, uttering fearful howls of rage, which, owing to the closeness of the rapport between them, seemed to come from the unfortunate young man. As I laid my hand upon him, however, he became suddenly silent, his limbs relaxed and he fell in a dead faint upon the floor, while the dark spirit seemed to crawl like a snake along the floor, wriggling its body away like a reptile. As it withdrew, it turned its head and looked at me, seeming to spit out its anger like venom upon me, and showing to my astonished eyes the face of a black slave. The face and the action were so exactly those of the vision shown me in Jalal ad-Din's mirror, that for half a moment I had almost forgotten the poor patient, till the voice of the Emir himself recalled me to a recollection of where I was. A few simple remedies soon restored the young man to his senses, and although terribly exhausted, he soon began to regain his strength. In reply to my inquiries, I was told that he had been subject to these attacks for some years, and when under their influence exhibited symptoms, which had alarmed and distressed his family so much that they feared for his reason if not for his life, since the last few attacks had reduced him to so terrible a condition of exhaustion it had been feared that each convulsion would prove his death struggle. I was highly praised for my successful treatment, dismissed with a very handsome present, and commanded to visit my patient again the next day. My friend the vizier assured me, as he conducted me from the room, that my fortune was made, since the young prince whom I had relieved was no less a person than the only legitimate son of the king of Persia. On visiting my illustrious patient next morning, I found him quite recovered, and contrary to his experience after former attacks, very little the worse for the present one, and I was again highly complimented upon my skill. For a week I continued my daily visits, and then was sent for once more in a hurry because the prince of Persia had been again seized with one of these strange and, to those round him, unaccountable fits of convulsions, although on this occasion the seizure was much less violent. As before, I found the cause to be the near approach of the black spirit, who, although the influence of my strong will interposed a barrier between him and the prince that prevented him from again touching him, was yet able to draw near enough to exert a considerable influence over him.